This is a paid message from GoFundMe. Meet Juan Naula. When his son was hospitalized for a viral infection, Juan started a GoFundMe to pay for medical expenses.
It was $5,000 to pay the bill for my son, and I needed only 22 hours. It was amazing. People really trust on GoFundMe.
How did Juan raise $5,000 in less than a day? He posted a short video on GoFundMe, telling his story in 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Be specific, be quick, and tell what are you going to be using the funds for. I was nervous to do it because it doesn't feel okay to ask money, but you shouldn't be nervous. Sometimes you just have to do it and see the results. We were able to save my son's life. Thanks to GoFundMe that we still have my son with us.
Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This message reflects one person's experience.
Future-proof extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Rana Gujral is a tech entrepreneur and AI expert, and he works in the cutting edge of how machines understand human behavior. He's the CEO of a company called Behavioral Signals, and he has a new book out called The AI Instinct, exploring how artificial intelligence is beginning to shape beyond how we work, how we influence, but also how we think too. Welcome to the program, Rana. Can you tell me a little bit about your work in AI and why you're interested in human behavior?
Honestly, it started with growing unease. I've spent my career building AI systems. I run an AI company. And the more I worked at the frontier of the stuff, the more I noticed the shift that nobody was really naming. AI stopped being a tool that sits outside us. It started participating in how we think, how we decide, how we understand the world. And that's a very different thing. So the other trigger was a conversation. You know, some of the best thinking behind the book came from long walks with my son, where we kept circling the same questions, reality, consciousness, free will, you know, all that good stuff. And so what any of it actually means when you have a system that increasingly resemble minds. So those weren't really abstract dinner party questions for me. They were the questions I couldn't stop thinking about after work. And I think the last one, I think then there's the fear I've had about drift. I don't think the big risk with AI is something like a dramatic catastrophe type of a situation. I think it's quiet. It's a slow outsourcing of judgment, a gradual weakening of the human agency, systems shaping our choices without our awareness. And none of this requires what people would say is coercion. So convenience is enough for it. Speed is enough for it. Optimization is enough. And that scared me more than any science fiction scenario. So I felt, I also felt the vocabulary we had was failing us. Like terms like AGI have become containers for too many meanings. When a concept means everything, it can't guide engineering. It can't really guide policy. It can't really guide public understanding. So part of what I wanted to do in the book is introduce sharper frameworks, including this idea of artificial general experience, because I think experience, not just capabilities, where the real story is heading. So ultimately, I think the book is my attempt to ask a better question, not what will AI become, but what will we become in relation to it? I mean, and can we evolve without losing what makes the evolution even worth having?
Yeah, I mean, if you take an even relatively tight definition of cyborg, you know, the idea that we now are able to think and make decisions in a way that is fully assisted by an artificial intelligence in the cloud, you know, there's no question that our behavior has dramatically changed as a result of this relationship. And I guess one of the things I wanted to know is how much does the AI know about us? I mean, have we developed systems that can really well determine tone, intents, if someone is maybe not fully confident or telling the truth, if they're upset? Do we have AI that can not just identify speech, but identify emotion?
Emotional intelligence, might be the most underrated skill of the next decade, and not for the reasons people usually say. Here's the thing, right? So we've spent a long time treating emotions as separate from thinking, as if the rational mind is the real mind and emotions are just noise. Mm. But we know now that's wrong. Emotions aren't the opposite of thought. They're a crucial part of it, right? They guide our decisions. They shape our judgment. They let us function intelligently in, say, messy, complex situations. So if you strip that out, you don't really get someone smarter. You get someone dangerously incomplete, brilliant, but hollow. And that's true for humans too, by the way. And that's why you've spent so much of my career building emotion AI and behavioral AI at Behavioral Signals. I mean, we're trying to teach machines to approximate what humans do kind of effortlessly, which is make fast, context-sensitive, emotionally intelligent judgments, intuition, basically, right? And because a highly capable AI without any emotional awareness is essentially, in my opinion, a very smart psychopath, and I don't think anybody wants that. So the flip side is that, and I think this is what I want the people to sit with, is as AI gets better at reading us, at stimulating, at simulating empathy, at responding to our moods, our own emotional intelligence becomes even more important, not less. And AI is getting better. To answer your specific question, yes, we have capabilities that do exactly those things. And I think, so emotional intelligence in an AI-driven world is really two things at once. It's what we need to build into the machine so they can serve humans well. And it's the internal instrument we need to sharpen in ourselves so we don't get shaped by systems we barely understand. And the people who thrive won't be the ones who outcompute AI. They'll be the ones who stay fluid in what makes them human.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of nervous about that because I feel slightly threatened. I was doing a sales pitch recently for my business, and afterwards I asked my AI to translate the transcript into insights. And I asked the AI what was not said by the client in this meeting. And it picked up on things that I hadn't noticed at all. So I hadn't realized that it said, well, you know, this particular buyer is nervous because they've been burnt before. And while I kind of thought that, if I was pressed on it, it identified this from the hesitancy, from the fact that it said a few sentences that had completely gone over my head. And there were two or three other things that it had intimated between pauses or lack of confidence saying yes to something, that there was a middle ground here and there's a gray area there and this is an opportunity. And that was the first moment that I thought, God, even just in our words and how we time our responses, there's a lot said. But then when you add an ability of AI to identify a specific emotion and say, this person is scared, this person is eager, this person is excited, that could be very useful in a healthcare environment, in emergency services, of course, in trying to deal with someone when they need help. But it could also be terrifying in the era of, AI sales, manipulation, extortion, fraud, and so on. And there's no real guardrails being put on this work still, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say the worry is very legit, and I don't want to dismiss it. I mean, something is going to shift for almost everyone. But I think the framing of replacement is actually the wrong lens. It's making people optimize for the wrong things. Here's what I've seen up close. AI systems that work best in the real world, the ones we build and deploy at Behavioral Signals, they don't replace the human. They enhance the moment. So a crisis hotline counselor gets a signal that vocal tension is rising and a supervisor comes on the line in like under 30 seconds. Like say a therapist gets sentiment trends over time so they can see when a patient is disengaging. So that AI doesn't really take the counselor's job. It makes the counselor sharper, faster, more present. That's the pattern that keeps showing up. So my honest advice is this, like stop trying to outcompute the machine. You'll lose that race. Every human will. What you want to double down on is the stuff that's genuinely hard for AI to do well. You know, judgment under ambiguity, reading a room, knowing when to stop, knowing when to ask for help, building trust with other human beings. But messy, contextual, emotionally intelligent work.
I've been giving talks saying this exact thing, right? But if you're telling me AI can soon identify emotions, can tell when someone is feeling a particular way, then that gives it that power. So how do you, you know, if it can tell all of the emotions, what do we have left?
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually want to come at it, you know, from a slightly different angle than the usual conversation, because I think the standard framing misses something important. Like most people, when they hear emotional intelligence in AI world, they think about it as a human survival skill, right? Like the machines will do the logic, will do the feelings, and that's how we stay relevant. Yeah. I don't buy that split. It's a comforting story, but it's wrong on both ends, right? So I think on the machine side, emotion isn't the opposite of intelligence. It's part of the architecture of good judgment. That's why I've been pushing this idea of a synthetic empathy layer sitting on top of a reasoning core in advanced AI. So think of it as a reflex, an early warning system that flags social and emotional context before the deeper processing even kicks in. Like, because a system that reasons brilliantly but can't sense that a person on the other end is in crisis or being manipulated or just exhausted, that system's not actually intelligent. It's just a very fast calculator with a very dangerous blind spot. And on the human side, emotional intelligence matter more, not less, because of what I call the synthetic experience. I mean, we're going to be surrounded by interactions that feel emotionally real, but aren't really reciprocal. I mean, a voice that listens without judgment, a companion that remembers everything, that warmth is calibrated to your emotional signature, and it lights up the same neural circuits as real connection. If you don't have strong emotional literacy, you won't notice the asymmetry. I mean, you'll just feel understood, and slowly your tolerance for the friction of actual human relationships will erode. So I think the role of emotional intelligence to me is dual. It's what we owe the machines we're building, honestly, and it's the muscle we need to keep training in ourselves so we can tell the difference between being met and being mirrored, like between connection and calibration. Mm. And that distinction is going to define a lot of what I think it means to live well in the next decade.
This concept of moving away from the friction of real human relationships, because the relationships that we will have with machines will be so addictive in a way, because the AI will both understand us. They'll know what to say. They'll know when not to say, because we'll have told it. These machines will have the capability to give us everything we think we need. And that, if we look at the way we've gone with technology, if we look at, you know, Amazon, instant delivery, you know, leave it at the door, DoorDash. The whole idea is you do not have a connection with this person. Online banking, everything. We're reducing person-to-person contact. Swipe left, swipe right. We're not having conversations with strangers to see if we want to sleep with them anymore. We're swiping on a screen. And these constant, you know, attacks on human-to-human interaction are the things that I really, really worry about, because, of course, AI is the ultimate. An AI can answer any question, solve any problem. You know, I wrote an article for Silicon Republic a while ago where I don't call my dad for problems with the plumbing anymore. I take a photograph of it and ChatGPT tells me how to fix it. And this is a real danger. I don't think people are fully aware that we are basically reducing our human-to-human contact as much as possible in the modern world. And it's leading to more tension, I think.
I mean, I agree, but I would actually reframe this a bit, because the word replaced hides what's really going on. Very few people wake up one morning and their job is gone, right? What actually happens is quieter. Pieces of your work gets absorbed. The parts that used to take you in an afternoon now takes 20 minutes. And the question becomes, what do you do with the reclaimed space? That's the real fork in the road. And the people I've watched thrive in this transition, they treat AI as a co-driver, not a replacement. I mean, there's a passage in the book where I talk about hybrid cognition in driving, where the AGI amplifies your reflexes, nudges attention towards hazards, like senses road frictions before you do. That's the mental model. You still get set the destination. You still say, hey, I want the safest route, or I want the fastest one. The machines handle the millisecond stuff. I mean, you handle the meaning. The second I'd say is...
By the way, pausing there, that's absolutely not how I want future of driving to be. I want the car to take me from where I want so I can chat with my friends or watch TV. That's what I want to do. I don't want to be partly in control of the car. I want the car to be fully responsible from getting me from A to B. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. Honestly, you're describing what most people actually want, and I think you'll get it, soon. Level 5, hands off, feel up, watch a movie, have a glass of wine, wake up at your destination. That's coming soon. But in a scenario I wrote about in the book, like the car is a co-driver, that's the messy middle. That's the next 10, 15 years where the technology is good enough to do most of the driving, but not good enough to take full liability in every condition. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, snowstorm in Vermont, construction zone with hand signal from a coworker, a worker, a kid chasing a ball across the street. You know, those edge cases are where the handoff problem lives. And that's where people are getting hurt right now. I mean, the Tesla case I wrote about, the driver charged with vehicular manslaughter after running a red light on autopilot. That's exactly the problem.
Yeah.
The marketing said one thing, the legal responsibility said another, and a person is dead, right? So when you say you want to just watch TV, I'm with you. But the question I'd ask is, who's accountable when it goes wrong? I mean, because right now the industry is quietly pushing that liability onto you, the driver, while selling you the fantasy of full autonomy. And that's what I called the accountability gap in the book. That's a real gap. It's not resolved, right? So once we get true level five, and I do think we will, the whole conversation changes. The manufacturer eats the risk, insurance restructures, and you get your TV time. Yeah. And I'm actually excited about that world. I just don't want us to sleepwalk into the version where we get all the passivity of full autonomy with none of the protection. That's the trap. And that's not the technology, the transition, actually.
There's been a lot of outcry, quite rightly, that ChatGPT has sort of allowed people to use its services for mental health. And it's gone horribly wrong because ChatGPT was never really designed for that. And it just, you know, spat out patterns. But, you know, in your book, you talk about intelligence and emotional intelligence, how we might better understand ourselves. And I, even though I don't want a world of just machines, I do feel like there is a massive opportunity for AI to help with the enormous mental health backlog. And I feel like an AI therapist is probably a good thing to a certain extent. I'm wondering what evidence you have or what work you've done that would suggest that that might actually be the case, even though all the headlines are quite rightly terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, the headlines are terrifying, and some of them should be, actually. I mean, we've seen generally awful cases where chatbots reinforce suicidal ideation and pretended to be licensed and just said something reckless because there's no clinical guardrail in the loop. That's real, and I'm not going to just hand wave it. But here's the fuller picture. The demand side of mental health is broken in a way most people don't fully appreciate. I mean, since the pandemic, the World Health Organization tracks something like a 25% jump in anxiety and depression globally. And in the US, you've got an insurance system that is frankly hostile to actually getting care. So you have millions of people who will never see a therapist. I mean, not because they don't want to, but because the supply isn't there and the access isn't there. The counterfactual isn't AI therapist versus great human therapist. It's AI-assisted care versus nothing at all. That changes, I think, the ethical math.
Yeah.
And you know, where I've seen it actually work, and there's published research on this now in the Journal of Medical Internet Research, is when the AI isn't pretending to be a therapist, it's augmenting one. So a generative tool supporting group therapy improved clinical outcomes and engagement, right? So behavioral intervention platforms reduced depression and anxiety symptoms in randomized trials. You know, Ellipsis Health, I think, comes to mind. Headspace tools like that are doing real-time triage, coping prompts, you know, mindfulness, nudges between sessions. Mm. The human's still in the loop. The AI is filling the empty space between the 50-minute appointments, which is where I think the most relapse and the most crisis actually happens. So I think the other piece is early detection. Emotion AI can pick up vocal tension, longer pauses, disengagement patterns a human might miss on Tuesday afternoon after 7 back-to-back sessions. That's not replacing empathy. That's giving the clinician, I think, a better instrument. So
yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that because I was on stage at the World Summit AI with a guy who was developing an empathy system for companies where they could assess the empathy of their employees by listening to the transcripts and analyzing how much they contributed, whether or not they were showing up late, whether or not they sounded positive. And that seems to me to be a very slippery slope and at the same time very appealing to employers who might say, look, we're just looking out for our employees, but actually they're also thinking this person is being very productive. They're you know, down today or they're depressed today. And I wonder if you think that's a good idea.
I think we have to be very careful. I think the answer is no. We don't want to necessarily monitor the emotional state of our employee. I think there's an aspect of privacy. There's an aspect of consent. It's necessarily a tool that's geared towards aspects of therapy from a client perspective, or aspects of giving a better customer service, or solving a customer's problem in a more of a live interaction, should it be turned inwards to sort of monitor, what the employee state of mind is, and use it or manipulate that towards a certain gain that a company would have? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one very entirely illegal and also very unethical.
Yeah. And I guess even no matter how you try and justify it by saying we can identify unhappy employees and all that, it does not morally wash. So in the book, you talk about sort of, emotions leaking out of the body. And you also talk about this idea of a joined computer and human model. Like, tell me about that.
You cannot read someone's mind. Nobody can. And what we can do is measure what I call semantic modulation, which is a fancy way of saying emotion leaks out through body, whether you want it or not, right? And so we have to be careful.
Like
there
what?
Needs to be consent.
When you say emotion leaks out of the body, what exactly are you meaning?
Right now, when I talk about out of the body, I'm pointing at something pretty radical. I'm talking about the idea that you, your identity, your continuous sense of self doesn't have to be locked inside one, biological container anymore. That's a huge shift from how humans have existed for entire history, right? So what I call this idea in the book is like a multi-substrate person, MSP. Think of like a single you whose memory, attention, and a thought process live across both flesh and compute, not a human using a tool, one agent spanning tissue, silicon, cloud-based systems simultaneously. So that's sort of the general idea. It's like two very different pathways here. I want to be clear about the distinction. One is the whole body emulation, which Bostrom and Sandberg have written about. That's like a replacement model. And then and whether you capture the brain structure, you simulate it, you upload it, and the person becomes a compute native entity, it duplicates. And that raises a genuinely disturbing question is the copy actually you? The other path that I find most compelling is hybrid cognition. That's the extension model. The human mind expands into new substrates without abandoning the original one. You're not replaced, you're distributed, you integrate.
Yeah, which sounds, both exciting and terrifying, which most of these concepts really are. That's Rana Gujral. He's CEO of Behavioral Signals and author of The AI Instinct.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.